Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. WikiLeaks last week published thousands of documents, secret files about CIA hacking tools that government employees use to break into users' computers, mobile phones, smart TVs from companies like Apple, Google, Microsoft, and Samsung. We're going to be talking about why the CIA did this, their cooperation with friendly foreign governments, and the U.S. National Security Agency to subvert the world's most popular technology platforms, how this can be prevented, what indeed was the extent of this hacking, why WikiLeaks got this information, who gave them this information. All of that is what we'll be discussing this hour of the program. Professor Richard Forno is our guest. He's a senior lecturer in the Department of Computer Science and Electrical Engineering at the University of Maryland. He directs the graduate cybersecurity program and serves as the assistant director of the school's Center for Cybersecurity. His 20-year career spans government, military, and private sector. He helped build a formal cybersecurity program for the U.S. House of Representatives, and he is our guest this hour. Our phone number for you to join this conversation is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is ideas at WPR.org, and we thank you very much for being with us. Hi, Rick. Thanks.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Yeah, very nice to have you with us. First of all, just explain to me, what is it? I was on vacation last week and wasn't totally following the news, which is unusual, but I had to do it. What did they release? What did it's a huge, huge number of files. What's in those files?
Well, the first takeaway is never go on vacation because you always miss the big story. What's in this trove of information is an unauthorized disclosure of the CIA's hacking tools and their vision about what they want to go after in terms of gathering intelligence by hacking into or exploiting devices, whether it's your Amazon Alexa, your Google Home, your smartphone, your TV, your car, all is part of what they do for intelligence gathering.
Mm-hmm.
We did hear that this was the first of a multi-part disclosure by WikiLeaks. So there's more to come, we're led to believe.
Mm-hmm. And they have assured us, or some other people have assured us, that nobody was doing any hacking of individual Americans. Is that true or not?
Well, that's believable. I mean, until it's proven otherwise. I mean, there are laws in place to prevent the intelligence community from targeting Americans. But as with any law, if you have the right lawyers in place, you can craft the law in a way that would allow these things to happen. So we don't know, quite frankly, whether or not Americans have been targeted.
Mm-hmm. And do you have any idea why the CIA would want to get into all of these? What were they looking for?
Well, the CIA, just like the NSA a few years ago with the Snowden disclosures, they're intelligence agencies, and their job is to collect information, secrets, and trends by America's friends and allies. That's part of what they do. So in the Cold War, they would tap phones and, you know, undersea cables and intercept mail and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now in 2017, it's all on the Internet, and it's all technology-based. So the intelligence community is adapting to the times, and they're certainly going after the technologies and the tools that their targets are using to, again, collect this information that would help American national security. So they're evolving with the times.
Rick, how would WikiLeaks have received this information?
It could come from any number of sources, and nobody really knows for sure except WikiLeaks. It could come from a leaker, an employee or a contractor taking this information, collecting it and taking it and shipping it to WikiLeaks. It could come from, students or interns or people assigned there on a short-term basis. We really don't know. We saw back in August, there was an NSA contractor who was arrested, and his home was a treasure trove of information, papers and documents that he had walked out of NSA with. So how this occurs raises some very interesting and disturbing questions. How does this stuff leave these agencies, and what can we do to better protect it?
Mm-hmm. You have said in a piece that you wrote recently that the latest disclosures remind us of the cybersecurity truism that any electronic device connected to a network can be hacked. That's amazing.
Yes. Well, it's something we've warned about, at least I've warned about since I've been in the field going back 20 years. It's one of the first things I was told when I was a student looking at IT and hackers and security. If you put something on the internet or you place a computer on a network, you run the risk of it being attacked. I remember back in the late 1990s, there was an ongoing competition to see how long it would take for a brand new Windows computer to be taken out of the box and plugged onto a network before it was attacked. And it went from an hour to 30 minutes to 10 minutes.
Wow.
So anything, any device, and not just computers, phones, smart refrigerators, all these things, if they're touching a public network, they run the potential of being attacked.
Mm-hmm. You also say that what we need to do is figure out some cyber defense efforts to protect sensitive information that we may have. Why don't we have those in place, and are they difficult to set up?
Well, that's, yes, it is very difficult to set up. It's very difficult then to operate effectively in an environment. The ideal environment to protect secrets is one that doesn't have networked computers, no internet access, and doesn't have people. Because people are ultimately responsible for stealing these secrets. So what we have to do is, number one, be more vigilant internally of who we allow access to our information, to our secrets, how we protect those secrets. Should one person have all the keys to the kingdom, or should it be distributed among several people? Technology can help, but ultimately it comes down to how do we deal with the people involved? How do we use these systems? How do we design these systems and these policies and procedures to make it more difficult for a bad guy to walk out with all this information?
Mm-hmm. Well, it would appear that we need to do that pretty quickly, right?
Yes, and we've said this before, and we'll probably say it again. We need to move quickly to fix the problem that is not going away anytime soon.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that's happened as a result of this dump, and you remind us of this, that we are just getting over the news about the cyber attacks, the hacking of the DNC, and possible Russian influence in the United States election in 2016. But now we launch these too, we realize. And you write, this isn't news, but it hurts America's reputation as a fair and above board player on the international stage.
Well, very much so, because, and you can go back even before the DNC hacks, so you can go back a few years prior to other incidents. We will present ourselves as being the straight shooters who are law-abiding and very above board in how we operate, but yet people in the know that we do this stuff. I mean, mm-hmm. Everybody hacks everybody else. Friends and allies and enemies will spy on each other. That's the way the game is played. That's the way intelligence has been gathered for generations. So that's not new. So it's a little disingenuous, I think, to on one hand say that we are totally above board or imply that we are, when in fact we're just as guilty of doing these things as our friends and adversaries.
Mm-hmm. And how concerned should we be about the leak itself? Another high-profile, you say, high-volume breach of information from a major U.S. government agency, at least the third significant one from the secretive intelligence community. Why so many so soon?
I can't answer why there are so many. I mean, I can speculate that there are apparently gaps in security and how information is protected. To me, this latest incident underscores the very real concern that the U.S. government itself has a hard time protecting its information. I mean, these are the intelligence community. These are the experts for keeping things
right,
secret.
Right.
No. And if they're having trouble doing it, well, what about OPM, which had 24 million-plus federal employees' records compromised? That's not a classified agency. What about other incidents in the federal government. So if the pros are having a hard time protecting mm-hmm. critical and secret information, it kind of puts things in a different light that, yes, this is an uphill battle all the time.
We're going to welcome phone calls for our guest, who is Professor Richard Forno, Senior Lecturer in the Department of Computer Science and Electrical Engineering at University of Maryland. He is Director of the Graduate Cybersecurity Program. He has done work in this area with the government, military, private sector, built a formal cybersecurity program for the U.S. House of Representatives, was the first Chief Security Officer for Network Solutions, and has advised several technology startup companies. I think Julian Assange said something about he would help companies, the tech companies, with cybersecurity. What's the deal with that?
The tech industry certainly is curious to learn about vulnerabilities that the government or others may have discovered in their products. The offer to help these companies out, I think, on one hand is it's a nice thought. But I think there's a fair amount of PR involved, in the sense that WikiLeaks wants to show that it's not just disclosing information for its own sake, but to try to help the companies out. Now, I read yesterday or Saturday that in Forbes, Google, Apple, and Microsoft had not been contacted by WikiLeaks to offer assistance of any sort. So whether or not there are any discussions, I don't know. The tech companies themselves need to balance cooperation or working with Julian Assange and WikiLeaks with their own concerns about working with, you know, the U.S. government as American companies.
Mm-hmm.
So where this ends up as far as who cooperates with who, I don't know yet.
And what do you think, I know we can't be sure of this, but what do you think would prompt Julian Assange to dump all these files?
Well, I think that's part of what WikiLeaks does. And again, I don't know the organization intimately. I've read various reports in recent weeks and months about them. Maybe it's just a matter of getting information out there and controlling a PR cycle. You know, ego might be involved, whether it's by Mr. Assange or by others at WikiLeaks, to show, look, we're a global player. We can influence things, whether it's, you know, elections or intelligence agencies or whatever. The motivations, are kind of murky right now.
Our number, 800-486-8655. We go to Teresa in Brookfield first. Hi, Teresa.
Hi.
Hi.
I've got a couple of comments. I think Julian Assange has got a chip on his shoulder for United States. I think it's very possible that he has just as much information on Russia and other countries as he does for the United States. But we're only leaking to the United States. I also think that nobody ever mentions all the ethical hackers, pen testers, white hat hackers, you know, whatever you want to call them, that are furiously working to try to keep our country safe. And also that they're paid a lot less money than the black hat hackers. And I think it's the FBI are paid horribly. So some of our top people are not paid the big money that, you know, all the fancy bear guys are getting in Russia, or even the independent ones that are in our country. And I don't think when you talk about being a hacker as a job, people think that's a bad thing to do. Well, my son is a pen tester and is quite far up in the certification. I think he's has all of them that he needs. And he's not paid as well as he could be, and it's a matter of wanting to keep America safe and protected, and it's easy to get caught up in the big money that everybody else can benefit from trading secrets and hacking.
Richard?
I think that's a very, very valid point the caller makes about the money difference. And as an educator myself, I see students that are, when they're facing graduation, they're facing a dilemma. Do I go to work for the government where I'm protecting my country and I'm a federal employee and I'm doing, you know, fighting the good fight? I may have job security and a much lower salary. Or do I go work for the Googles, the Amazons, the Microsofts, the Apples, where I can make three, four times the amount have a much better work-life balance, perhaps, not deal with security clearances at my job. It's a very difficult decision, and certainly when you're looking at dollars and cents, the government can't compete. So that's a very important question, and one that students and hiring managers all over are dealing with.
Can you explain more about the white hats, black hats?
Sure. In the security industry, a black hat hacker is the proverbial bandit with a mask covering his face or her face and is the evildoer. Mm. The black hat is going to hack and cause mischief and do all these things because, for whatever reason, they want to cause mischief, they want to collect information, work for a criminal, whatever. They're the bad guys.
Okay.
By contrast, the white hat hackers are the good guys. If you think back to the old Western movies in the 50s and 60s, the bad guys always wore black hats, and you could always tell who they were in any movie you watched. And the good guys always wore a white hat, and they were the ones that would save the day, and they fought the good fight. Mm. That's the white hat, black hat difference moving into the Internet age.
Are the lines as clear-cut as that? Can you have white hat guys and gals who might have not have completely pure purposes?
Yes, and there's the gray hat hacker, which is somebody you take black and you white, you muddy it up,
right.
You get gray. And these are folks that have technical skills, but they aren't necessarily bound by any particular maybe ethical system other than their own. So they might work, help out a good guy one time, they might help out a bad guy some other time. It really depends. We see all stripes of hackers, white hat, black hat, gray hat. It's, that's been around for a while as well.
More phone calls momentarily, 800-486-8655 if you'd like to join us. Professor Richard Forno is our guest. We're talking about the release last week from WikiLeaks of all kinds of central intelligence information related to computer hacking, close to 9,000 different files, and we're discussing who leaked it, what it means about what can be hacked, and it's pretty amazing how TVs, smart TVs, and refrigerators and all kinds of things can be hacked, and the reasons for that. Richard is a senior lecturer in the Department of Computer Science and Electrical Engineering at University of Maryland. He directs the graduate cybersecurity program. We'll take more phone calls momentarily here on the Ideas Network. All right, let's go to some messages that have come in. Paul wants to know your thoughts, Rick, on FBI admitting to be able to hack the iPhone, like in San Bernardino.
Well, the FBI themselves didn't hack the iPhone. They contracted out to a company believed to be an Israeli firm, paid them some money to research and find a way in to get what they needed off the phone. That being said, this does tie back to what WikiLeaks had released the other day, where the CIA had been working on ways to deal with this very problem by not attacking the encryption, but by attacking the phone itself, the operating system on the phone, in essence going around the encryption technologies. So the FBI certainly is still very interested in the encryption issue. In fact, Director Comey the other day again said that his biggest concern is terrorists and criminals using encryption to go dark, and it makes their job in doing forensics and collecting evidence much more difficult.
We go next to Anne in Milwaukee. Hello, Anne.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
My question has to do with the fact that the WikiLeaks revealed that one of the intents of the CIA was to leave behind fingerprints of other organizations or countries so that their hacking of particular electronics would go undetected. And I was wondering what your guests thought about that in terms of the so-called fancy bear fingerprints that were left behind on the DNC hack, or the fingerprints that were left behind on the single malware that was put onto the computer and whether or not, in fact, this makes that so-called evidence be called into question.
That's a very interesting point. Some of the tools that were disclosed by WikiLeaks did indeed show that the CIA was working on hacking tools that would make it appear as if somebody else was doing the dirty work and mm-hmm. not them. In the intelligence community, they call that a false flag, so that you might think Russia is attacking, but really it's China or somebody else. That's not surprising to see them researching such capabilities. Again, these types of things are what intelligence agencies around the world have looked into for decades in various ways, and now it's moved online. Could this have some bearing on the discussion about the hacking of the DNC and the allegations that it was Russia and the Russian connection with the presidential campaign? Possibly. Again, I'm not on the inside. I don't have any, special information. It's theoretically possible that, yes, somebody could have made these attacks look like they came from Russia. But speaking as somebody who's been in the D.C. area for a good long time, I don't think that the CIA was trying to hack the election to blame Russia to rig things. I don't see that happening. But the caller does raise a very interesting point that, again, this technology does exist, and it's not a new idea. Mm-hmm. I mean, researchers have looked into this stuff for decades. Mm.
Anything else, Ann?
No, but thank you very much for having this guest on. It's an interesting conversation.
Thanks, Ann. Thanks very much for the call. How difficult is it, this question coming from somebody who doesn't have a whole lot of understanding of computers beyond what's necessary and basic. How difficult is it to do all of this hacking? Are we talking about, college degree and computer technology and beyond?
The ability to hack a computer or to cause mischief in some way really just requires having the right set of technical skills and an evil mind, or an evil mindset, if you will. You don't need to necessarily go through, 20 years of training and education or whatnot. I know what many career security folks who don't have college degrees, but they were self-taught, they learned, they've risen through the ranks in corporate America, and they're doing very well. They've done great things. They've invented new technologies to help the security industry. So the average layperson certainly wouldn't be able to do these types of things, but there are tools out there that make it easier for an average person to cause mischief. Maybe not to the same degree as the CIA or the NSA, but you don't need to be a technical genius to cause mischief in cyberspace.
Mm-hmm. Pepin is next in Milwaukee. Hello, Pepin.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my question. I just saw a report over Twitter today that from what I could understand, pretty credibly links WikiLeaks, at least two of their servers are apparently pretty definitively inside of Russia. And I'm just wondering, with the timing, with the investigation that's going on into Donald Trump, is it possible that Russia gave WikiLeaks this information purposely to deflect attention away from Trump's ties with Russia?
That is an interesting possibility. I don't have any inside knowledge on that. I've not heard that report. It certainly is plausible that WikiLeaks has servers in Russia, just like other companies, organizations, Microsoft, Apple, others would have servers in those countries too. So the presence of the servers in Russia, I don't think it can be taken too seriously as a relationship between WikiLeaks and the Russian government. But is there a possibility that the Russians acquired information that would be damaging to the U.S. and gave it to WikiLeaks? It's a possibility. I believe WikiLeaks has denied that in the past. They've said they've had no direct contact with the Russian government. However, that leaves a lot of open interpretation for non-government people to have discussions and interactions. So to answer your question, in short, it's possible, but I don't know for sure.
Hmm. Let's talk about some other cases here for a moment. You mentioned the largest U.S. government data loss incident was the 2014 Office of Personnel Management breach that affected huge number of people, 20 million current and former federal workers and their families. including you, I believe, but the U.S. has never truly secured its digital data against cyber attackers. A couple questions, obviously, why haven't they? And the other part is, why would anybody hack into 20 million current and former federal workers? What's everybody looking for there?
Well, I think the first question is to why haven't we secured our information is just a matter of, I think, bureaucratic processes take too long. I mean, the government and large organizations don't move on internet speed. They are very slow to act and adapt to buy and deploy new technologies and implement policies and processes that can make it more difficult for these data breaches to take place. That's one part of it. Another part is what I call the human factors. The fact that you, even in 2017, you can still trick somebody into clicking a link in an email from somebody they don't know who it's where it's from. And by clicking that link, they could get their computer infected and create a backdoor for a bad guy to come into their network and do damage.
Mm-hmm.
That's 2017. We've been saying don't click on links for decades.
Mm-hmm.
People still do it. To your third question as to why would you want to get this personal information?
I mean, yes.
Names, addresses, histories, that's all boring. That's useless, right? No.
Right.
This information can be very useful to a foreign government or a criminal organization to identify connections between where people work. Maybe somebody was a spy undercover, and you could marry up their employment history and their travel history and draw connections. We live in an age of big data.
Mm.
So if you could take all this information, names, addresses, social security, biometric information like fingerprints and iris scans from your eye, you can take all this information. You can then marry it up with other sources of information, public records, media reports, interviews, things like that,
mm-hmm.
and develop a picture of somebody that you might want to go after and target, whether it's in person or in cyberspace. So that's a treasure trove of useful information that can help a bad guy target America, the United States.
Mm. But 20 million people, that's a lot of people to go through, isn't it?
Not for a large computer, it's not.
Huh.
The records are detailed. The current background questionnaire for federal employees is about 100 pages. Now, not everybody uses 100 pages, but there's a lot of information per person, but that's still just bits and bytes in a computer. That can be parsed fairly easily and analyzed and searched to look for, you know, matching items. So it's not difficult for an adversary who has this information to analyze it for various purposes.
Mm. Pepin, thanks for the call. We have some lines open if you've been trying to get through. Our lines have been crowded. The number is 800-486-8655. We're talking about the files that WikiLeaks released last week, thousands of documents, secret files about the CIA hacking tools that government employees use to break into computers, mobile phones, smart TVs from companies like Apple, Google, Microsoft, and Samsung. And that's what we're discussing this hour. What were they looking for? How sophisticated this all is? Why there aren't measures in place to keep this from happening? Our guest is Professor Richard Forno. He's a senior lecturer in the Department of Computer Science and Electrical Engineering at the University of Maryland. He conducts the graduate cybersecurity program, and he's done a lot of work for the government, military, and private sector, including helping build a formal cybersecurity program for the U.S. House of Representatives. 800-486-8655 is the number. David in Ironwood is next. Hi, David.
Yeah, the black hat, white hat is just too simplistic. You can have well-meaning people doing good things. I mean, the fact that we attacked Iran's subterfuges through a virus that we caught. But then we were dumb enough that they were able to find it and then look at the code and maybe in the future use it against us. I mean, if they're going to have such deadly computer viruses, they should have some type of self-destruct thing so that it doesn't fall into our enemy's hands. And also, I mean, they already have, I was watching this science show where they can read a few thoughts, what I call it. Maybe in the future, they'll read your mind. Would you want the government to be able to read your mind?
Rick.
Sure. Well, to answer the last question, no, I don't want anybody to read my mind except me. That said, though, the question about Stuxnet, which was an attack a few years ago that targeted the Iranian nuclear program successfully, raises a question about the nature of technology and the vulnerabilities that are discovered. So let's say I'm a security researcher and I find a vulnerability, a problem on a product, whether it's Microsoft Windows, Apple, whatever. I find this vulnerability. Okay, that vulnerability doesn't know I'm a good guy or a bad guy, a white hat, a black hat. It just, it's there. It's like a door to your house. It will open and close for anybody. So I agree with the caller's point that, well, how come there's no self-destruct mechanism on these tools that we're using? The problem is you can't design these tools that way. If you find a weakness, that weakness doesn't discriminate when you attack it, and that's a problem. So it's, the analogy is you can't unring a bell. We can't unlearn a given vulnerability. All we can do is, you know, be good people and better people and not abuse the privilege, shall we say. But the question of vulnerabilities in technology, that ties into what we talked about earlier about the FBI director with encryption. There's been a lot of talk in Washington for going back 20 years about we must have the ability to crack encryption. And proposals are floated to reduce the strength of encryption to make it easier for the government to access encrypted communications. The problem is by weakening the security, it not only helps the good guys, the government, do their job, it makes it easier for the bad guys to do bad things. And that's the dilemma we're facing with a lot of these cyber tools and our approaches to technology. You know, it sounds good on paper, but when we think about it in practice, we have a very gray area that there's no easy solution to fix.
Barbara in Dubuque sends this email. She finds it interesting that WikiLeaks refuses to release Donald Trump's tax forms, even though they have admitted to having access to them. What about what they release and what they don't?
I think what they release and what they don't, and the timing of what they release and when, suggests that there is an agenda, a political agenda, to their actions. WikiLeaks purports to be a journalistic organization, and they will disclose things as they find them. But at the same time, they will time their releases for maximum publicity, maximum impact, as we saw during the elections last year, as we saw 2 years back with the Chelsea Manning documents about the Iraq helicopter videos. There's an agenda there, and I believe it is a partisan agenda. I'm not saying it's pro-Donald Trump or anti-Hillary Clinton or anti-Russia, but there are agendas involved. And if they do have information about other people and entities that they haven't released, I would wonder why they haven't done that yet.
Mm. Thanks, David, for your call. Let's go to Rod in Weyerhaeuser. Hi, Rod.
Yeah, hello. Thank you, Kathleen. Another interesting program. Say I was just going to have to demand two questions. Okay, when we went into Iraq, the Bush administration was praised for a while, then after a while we could see what was happening, and then they started saying, well, it was all wrong. I'm just wondering, all that information about WMDs, was that all screwed up through hacking, a possibility? And then my second question is, what if you've got a psychopath out there that can he tap into the Strategic Air Command, you know, with all the nukes, the big nukes, and showing an all-out attack so that then we respond by an attack and she's all over.
Right. Okay. To your first question, the 2003 run-up to Iraq, to my knowledge, hacking wasn't involved. What did happen, the intelligence that was proved to be ultimately wrong was misinterpreted or generated in a way that would lead to a certain outcome. In other words, we're going to create documentation and the evidence we need to justify the invasion. That's a whole conversation for perhaps another program down the road with folks from the intelligence and State Department circles. As far as the control of our nuclear weapons go, interestingly, on the campaign trail, President, the candidate Trump made a comment about why are America's missiles and nuclear silos still running off of floppy disks? That people today might wonder what a floppy disk is even. But the systems there are 30 and 40 and 50 years old. They're not connected to the public internet. They're, you can't hack them from overseas or even here. It doesn't work that way. They're totally separate. And that's intentional. And that's a good security tool. You don't want somebody intentionally or accidentally to launch nuclear weapons.
No, you sure don't. Does that make you rest a little easier, Rod?
Yeah, I was kind of thinking that too, because I had heard a program that they were running off of, you know, 30, 40-year-old systems or whatever, and I thought that might be the reason because of the fact that they couldn't be hacked.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Right, and part of the problem now is that, and this came up because we're looking to modernize large parts of our nuclear arsenal, and you can't buy parts to fix some of these old computers anymore. So now the question is, well, if we use modern technology, can we still get that same level of protection that we had with this older, antiquated technology?
Yeah. Thanks, Rod.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
More phone calls momentarily at 800-486-8655. The email is ideas at WPR.org, and we're also on Twitter at KDunnShow. We're talking about the publication by WikiLeaks last week of thousands of documents, and those concern they are secret files about CIA hacking tools that the government employees use to break into users' computers, mobile phones, smart TVs. It has yet to be confirmed whether or not these are authentic, although indications are that they are. How did WikiLeaks obtain this information? And why is it that we don't have systems in place to keep this from happening? That's what we're talking about with our guest, Richard Forno. And we'll take more phone calls in a moment. Lines are open for you if you'd like to join us. 800-486-8655 is the number. This is the Ideas Network. 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655, or ideas at WPR.org for you to send messages to our guest this hour. And the verification of these files, who decides if they are to be verified? And have you heard that they are? Do you suspect that these are real, that WikiLeaks dumped?
Well, the CIA will certainly not publicly confirm the authenticity of these files anytime soon, if ever. That's not something they would do. But you can be assured that they're going through this document, this trove, to confirm and verify and see where things may have come from. And that would be part of their internal investigation into how this occurred.
Mm-hmm. Tell me, because we don't have the security devices to keep this from happening, tell me about what hackers could conceivably do. I understand that, you know, U.S. government employees, including the President of the United States, use many of these products that are susceptible to hacking. So what could hackers get a hold of that we sure wouldn't want them to get a hold of?
Well, as I said at the start of the hour, anything that's electronic and, you know, is network connected can be attacked or compromised in some way. A great example would be what happened a few weeks ago when the president was down in Florida and the North Koreans launched a nuclear test.
Yes.
And the attendees at the banquet pulled out their cell phones and were taking pictures of him conferring with his staff.
Mm-hmm.
Well, all those phones are on a network, and they could be, you know, if some bad guy, somebody knew who was there, could they target those phones to turn them into microphones to listen in on what was being said? What pictures were taken at that meeting that could be intercepted and then used, you know, for intelligence gathering? That's just, you know, some examples.
Right.
Devices around the house, your Google Homes or your Amazon Alexas, these are wonderful technologies that are fun, they're convenient, kids love them, and they're handy. But if you think about it, what are they but a microphone that is always on and always listening? That's scary. even your car with smart automotive technologies, things like OnStar and internet in the cars, okay, your car may not necessarily be a private place to have a very private conversation anymore. Again, thinking worst case scenario here, I'm not saying that, you know, every car is suddenly becoming a bugging room, but you have to be cognizant, to be aware that technology devices are all around us. Any one of them can be exploited for various purposes.
Mm. We go to Steve in Lake Geneva. Hi.
Yes, hi there. I'm just curious if there are any large, sustained community efforts to build a highly secure, open, standards-based, multi-platform password manager that supports TOTP and YubiKey 2FA, as well as a browser extension and mobile apps with minimum code. I see most commercial password managers, the code source code is not available or it's not open for public inspection, from what I understand, and hence many security experts are wary about relying on these things for password management. And even though there's an effort to reduce or minimize password management, my understanding is that it's still going to be something that we're going to need to do for the foreseeable future. I'm just curious what your response is to that.
Sure. And for those that are listening, there was a lot of jargon and
yes, I didn't get that.
In that question.
Right.
That's okay. We don't have to worry about that. But the question really comes down to password managers are becoming more and more popular pieces of software that people can store all their passwords and user IDs in one location that they can access from their phones, their tablets, their computers, wherever else. And the question, as I understood it, was, are there community attempts by the hacker community and the security community at large to develop a product that is where the source code, how it works, can be reviewed by third parties or the public, by knowledgeable programmers. In other words, we're not taking the vendor's word that this product is secure and safe and, you know, trust us to store all your passwords. There are some products that are out there. Again, I'm not going to list a bunch of them right now, but there are some community efforts to design software that is accountable and auditable that serve that purpose. But the other part of the caller's question about the need for passwords is still very important. Even though it's 2017 and we've got, you know, all kinds of ways to secure data, it still a lot of times comes down to having good passwords and, you know, keep not reusing passwords between sites and services.
Mm. And what's a good password?
It would be one that I'm not going to say on air. No, a good password would be one that is not just an easily guessable password, like a dictionary word, like a random word with a couple of numbers on it, but something that's a mix of letters and numbers, maybe a certain pattern on a keyboard that you know how to type something and you can rotate that sequence every year or so to change your password.
Mm-hmm.
Something that's hard enough for a person to guess, but not so hard that you're going to forget what it is.
Okay. Thanks very much, Steve, for your call. Ray in Milwaukee. Hi.
Yeah, I just tuned in. I just find it really, really fascinating that the book 1984 is flying off the shelves again. And as it turns out, this dump is things the CIA obviously did not want us to know. And maybe it's best if you want a journal or diary or whatever that normally you would do online, you better start using pencil and paper and get in the corner of your room, away from the television, away from your cell phones. And I just would like to hear the guest reflection on that. And just it's fascinating to me that 1984 predicted this, and now with Donald Trump as our big brother, we should all be really, really terrified.
What I would say to that is the caller is indeed right. I agree with a lot of that. What it comes down to is if you think something is very sensitive or very important in your life, like a document is important, don't put it on the internet. Don't put it on your Facebook account. Don't post it to LinkedIn or Twitter. Keep it off of a networked service. I wouldn't say we have to go back to pen and paper days, but that certainly may be a more secure way if you're ultra paranoid. to go that route. But I think this really, what it comes down to is the current day we're in. We have to balance our need to get things done and live in this modern information world, but also balance that efficiency with some degree of security and trust. I don't think we can do that by going back to pen and paper and going completely offline. There's got to be a happy medium, and that's what folks in the security industry are trying to find.
Hmm. I'm trying to remember what he was referencing, but didn't Donald Trump talk about sending things by courier at one point?
I believe, yes. Was it during the campaign he said he would probably use couriers because he wouldn't transmit anything? And I know... There was, I think, a New York Times piece about how he would send legal documents by bike courier to New York City as opposed to faxing them because he didn't trust the fax machines. There's truth to that. It may not be convenient, but there is some truth to what he did.
Mm-hmm. And yet he uses Twitter all the time.
That's one of the big security concerns we have, is how he uses Twitter. Can that Twitter account be hacked, which would potentially create all kinds of problems?
Oh, yeah. And
could that phone he's using be compromised in some way and turned into a microphone? Can you imagine having a microphone in the presence of the president and he doesn't know it's there?
Wow.
That would be very, very damaging to American security.
Do you write novels, too?
No.
I bet you could
not
write
yet.
Not yet. I'll bet you could write a good one. Ray, thanks so much for your call. John and Mason. Hi, John.
Hi. I just have a quick comment. I'm wondering if either of you or any of the listeners have seen either of these two movies. One is called The Listening, and it's about technology that's real, where they can listen. And every time I hear a program like this, I think about these, where even if the phone is on the hook, a landline phone, they can hear through the landline and through cell phones and everything else. And certain words are listened for, and when those words are heard by the technology, they lock onto it, onto that user's phone, and get all the information.
It's called The Listening? The movie is The Listening?
The Listening.
Okay.
The science technology is real. The story is fiction, but I mean, how much is anymore?
Right.
The other movie is called Just Listening, and it's just from a year or two ago, and it's about these two college students that are trying to develop this I guess you'd call it wetware, where they're able to read each other's minds. And the government has secretly been trying to figure this out themselves and not having any luck, and these college students succeed. And it's just an incredible movie.
Right.
You familiar with those?
I'm not familiar with either one of those movies, although they do sound like they'd be interesting to watch. Mm-hmm. But that you raised the question about the ethics of technology, and there are whole articles and books and classes on, you know, how do we approach the use of technology as it evolves and how we make it better, and what does that mean for us, you know, in the human world, to balance the capabilities of technology with our humanness, if you will. But those are interesting movies. I will certainly check them out when I can.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for the call. Well, it's been a fascinating hour, Richard. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. It was fun.
It was fun for us, too, but slightly disturbing. Professor Richard Forno, our guest this hour, he's a senior lecturer. He's in the Department of Computer Science and Electrical Engineering at the University of Maryland in Baltimore County. He directs the Graduate Cybersecurity Program. He also has worked with the government, with the military, and the private sector, including, this is interesting, to help build a formal cybersecurity program for the U.S. House of Representatives. With us this hour to talk about WikiLeaks releasing the trove of Central Intelligence Agency information related to its computer hacking, and we thank him for helping us understand all of this. Well, tomorrow during this time, just a reminder, you may have seen this piece in the New York Times yesterday. It's an interesting story that looks at the strong link between sleep and sunlight and mood, that they're very, very connected, and that your sleep schedule may be affecting your mental health. So we'll be looking at that with a psychiatrist, I believe, tomorrow during this particular hour. Thanks very much. as always, to Scotty Myers for producing this hour, and thanks to Colleen Duvall for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee, where it's still snowing. Probably is where you are, too, just snowing all day long. Thanks to both of them, and thanks to you for listening and participating in the program. We'll be with you again tomorrow at 1 o'clock. News from NPR is coming up next.